property except for tax liens and labor liens. And so currently the person to protect themselves, if they were buying personal property, would need to check the county clerk's office now to protect themselves, because if the Employment Division filed a notice of claim of lien under the existing statute with the county clerk's office alone, and you just checked the Secretary of State's office, you would not be protected.
Sounds like we need to amend that.
No, what we're doing here, we're not in the work session, but is we're simply having the state follow the procedures that are done in private transactions to secure purchases of businesses with personal property. They secure it by filing the UCC financial statement with the Secretary of State. The state's now going to do the same, and that will leave the public from having to worry about checking the county clerk's records for personal property liens when the state's involved. Is that correct?
That's correct, Chairman Bauman. That was one of the advantages of this. It would be our ability then to file the warrant at the county level, which would enact a judgment at that time, file it with the Secretary of State, and that would be a statewide thing. That would be a place that a lender or a creditor could go to then to determine whether there was a lien or a warrant out.
Okay.
Point of clarification, ORS 657540, print 3, is the priority statute for these liens that you're talking about, and it says the lien created by this section is prior to all liens and encumbrances recorded subsequent to the filing of the notice of claim of lien. I thought, I just heard you say a minute ago that as soon as you filed this thing, you went ahead of any liens that, security interests that may have been recorded anywhere prior to that time.
Chairman Baum, Representative Johnson. No, if I said it that way, I did not intend it that way. All I was making clear was that once you have filed, you do have the lien against the personal property. And it would be, if someone who was trying to do something after that date would need to check with the county to be protected.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions of Mr. Lent, Mr. Jordan, or Ms. Hunter? Any questions from the committee members? Any further witnesses on House Bill 2082? I'd like to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2082. I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2082. We got a bunch of nervous nillies. From a practitioner's point of view, I think this makes it a lot simpler. I mean, we're going to be able to go to the Secretary of State's office, is my understanding, if I correctly interpret this bill, and have one place where you can pick up all the liens on personal property, including the ones the Employment Division could have possibly filed underneath you at the county clerk's office, where you wouldn't have thought to go look, and no title company is going to search it. But it's all kind of directs it all into one place and does a little bit of cleaning up the statute so it's a little bit more consistent. So I think it's a good bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, Representative Clark.
I'd agree with your point, except the statute, look at the bottom of the page, it says a copy of this, et cetera, may also be filed in the Secretary of State's office. It doesn't require that it be filed in the Secretary of State's office, so they don't have to do it there. They could still sneak in something in the county and nobody checking at the Secretary of State's office would even know it was in existence.
Well, what we're saying is that they intend to collect the... Why don't we come up here? Tell us the language, why it's not shall versus may. We're on line 28, aren't we, Representative
yes.
Johnson?
Yes, Chair.
I mean, I guess if they don't intend to collect it, they're not going to file one. But go ahead and address that may and shall, may
Chairman
versus shall.
Representative Johnson, the may is there to allow flexibility. We intend to file these warrants with the Secretary of State. We're going to try to get a feel for the success rate in doing it that way. We don't want to overwhelm the Secretary of State with a flurry of paper at the very start. We have, I think, Roger, about 17,000 warrants a year right now. Some of those are not necessarily something we would want to file with the Secretary of State if it's just in one particular county and there's no possibility that we could get money on a statewide basis. Is that 1900?
Representative Bryan, while you're still here, I guess that leads me to the question of any comments that the Secretary of State's office might have on this. and whether or not the effect on revenue statement that we have from legislative fiscal includes extra staff they may be asking for as a result.
Chairman Baum, Representative Bryan, we have checked with the Secretary of State's office. They feel that this is a good idea. They do not indicate that there's any problem in handling the workload. There is a similar program that the Department of Revenue has had in place since 1989, and the Department of Revenue averages about, 1990 was 62 filings with the Secretary of State. So,
62?
I believe that's what the impact statement says.
Representative Bryan, go ahead.
You're talking 17,000.
We would not be filing that number. That's why I'm saying that we need the May in here. We don't want to absolutely wipe them out. There are some that we would get a bigger bang for the buck in filing a warrant on with the Secretary of State than in others.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, you want to discuss?
Well, I'm just looking at paragraph 2 of section 1. It talks about the lien shall be perfected and attached. And section B says to personal property wherever located in the state, and that's where you get to the statewide thing. That is the one that requires them to file it with the Secretary of State's office. Sub B of B requires that. But back up on sub A of 2, line 14, anything in the county is encumbered even without a filing with the Secretary of State's office. And I guess, again, worrying about the poor practitioner that may forget to check all these places, seems to me that we ought to have a system in civil law in this state where if you want to put a lien on a piece of real property, somebody wants to borrow some money and give you back a security interest, we should have a system set up where for personal property they check with the Secretary of State. And if there's nothing there, you go ahead and do it.
You have any comment about that?
Chairman Baum and Representative Johnson, again, Roger corrected me. We have about 1,900 warrants that we file on an annual basis. It varies between 1,700 and 1,900. I'm not at all sure that the Secretary of State would want to handle all of those warrants. I understand the philosophical issue that you're talking about there. I would like to think that we could give this a try and start out with the first year. Again, we have that flexibility there and give this whole new warrant process a try and build up the number of warrants that we send to the Secretary of State when we get some experience.
So what this bill accomplished is, now I'll call Representative Clark a minute, is that we have the real and personal property warrants are still possibly going to be recorded in individual counties.
They could be. Mm-hmm.
And that on the more significant matters, you may go to the Secretary of State's office with a more significant claim. In the meantime, we still have the practitioners out there kind of caught in between. They don't know whether they have to check the county clerk records and the Secretary of State. So we've given you an additional avenue to collect it, but because we keep the language in there and personal property on line 14, we still have the situation where there's still going to be a double check required to escape malpractice.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
Just to follow up on that question of counsel, there are other, it seems to me, there are other places that the general other times when the general practitioner has to check a couple of different places. Isn't that correct? Or have we eliminated that?
We've been trying to work on that.
I know we've been trying to eliminate that, but aren't there still, I mean, I just asked counsel, my guess is you check two places.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that's correct. The trend in the practice has been to eliminate as many times that you have to check in two places as possible, but most practitioners still check in the county records and with the Secretary of State.
You have something you're going to say in response to
Chairman
Mr.
Baum,
Jordan?
I would just make one comment with respect to that. There are similar provisions for liens for the Department of Revenue and Safe Corporation, which have filings with the counties, which provide personal property liens, and which are not filed with the Secretary of State. So I just, if you were going to address that issue, I just wanted you to be aware that there are other state liens that are created on personal property that are filed solely with the county.
We're probably not going to be sending any bills out of here with relating clauses on workers' comp, so we'll probably leave that alone. So the major benefit of this bill, then, is it gives you an additional pure, simple avenue of notice and collection.
This is, Chairman Bellman, it is to improve our collection efforts on delinquent accounts.
Okay.
As well as cut down on the paper and the cost of making those collection efforts.
Any further comments, discussion?
Mr. Chair, are you looking for a motion?
You have any further concerns, Representative Sachin?
Yeah.
We're not eliminating the... we're just on the, probably can count on the fact that on the bigger claims against employers, they're going to be recording to the Secretary of State's office. So those people that are operating under the assumption that all personal property liens are perfected to the Secretary of State's office are going to pick up the big ones, but the little ones are still going to be at the courthouse, and they're going to have to continue to check. So that's just where it leaves us.
They already do.
Which most of them already do. In other words, we ought to just move with this because the big change is beyond the scope of this committee. Getting two or three other workers' comp and revenue department.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clark.
I will move House Bill 2082 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Representative Clark has moved House Bill 2082 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bryan?
Aye.
Representative Clark?
Aye.
Representative Edmondson?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Mannix? Representative Miller?
Aye.
Representative Bell?
Aye.
Chair Baum?
Votes aye. House Bill 2082. Al, and put Mark down that Representative Bell votes aye. We're glad to see that the high chair has taken care of the members of the committee. We acknowledge that House Bill 2082 received the appropriate vote and will be forwarded to the full committee to due pass recommendation. Representative Miller will carry the bill. No?
No, I was thinking Representative Bell, but you handled it pretty well, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you were.
Representative Clark will carry it. We appreciate the help. Go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2082 and open up a work session, a public hearing, excuse me, on House Bill 2126. And counsel will brief the members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2126 relates to the regulation of timeshares. There are two parts to this bill. First, it makes retroactive a provision that allows owners to get a trustee appointed to help manage the property. It does it, and this is a little bit hard to follow, so you need to look on your copy of the bill. It's on Section 2, which is at the bottom of Page 2. What the bill does is it deletes from a section of the current Act a provision that is expressly not retroactive. So by taking out a section from the not retroactive section, it becomes retroactive. You're welcome. In your materials, you have some prepared testimony from the real estate agency. There are also some amendments that have been proposed both by the real estate agency and by the state court administrator. The amendments are basically the same. And from my conversations with representatives of both offices, my understanding is that the consensus is that the state court administrator amendments should be adopted. They're somewhat more than technical, but don't make a major change. It has to do with who notifies who about trustees' actions. And in addition, House Bill 2127, which we'll be hearing after this, deals with memberships in campgrounds. My understanding is that the representative of the real estate agency is going to briefly address the committee on both bills before we get into hearing additional testimony on them. There are no fiscal impacts on either of 2126 or 2127.
Well, we appreciate that. And to whom it may concern, we'll proceed right on. We'd like to go ahead and invite Mr. Mayfield and Morella Larson. Are they together? We'd like to extend a welcome to you. It's not often we get a real estate commissioner to come into the Judiciary Committee. I hope it's a good sign for us and just a limited experience for you.
I'll drink to that.
But in any case, we'd also like to welcome you, Mr. Mayfield. Whoever wants to sally forth first is perfectly welcome to. I guess the fingers point your way, so Ms. Larson, carry forth. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Baum and members of the committee. I am Morella Larson, Real Estate Commissioner, Administrator of the Real Estate Agency. And thank you for your attention to these two bills today. And, of course, with me, as you've just indicated, Stan Mayfield. Stan is the manager of our Special Programs Division, and this encompasses the land development activities that we have in our agency, including the timeshare law and the membership camping campgrounds law. He will be actually explaining the bills to you. The timeshare bill is actually one that falls in the category of cleanup. The campground bill actually has a little bit more of a significant change in it, because it does some additional things. We are a consumer protection agency, and we have regulatory responsibility. Both of these bills contribute to improving our regulatory ability to assist in the prevention of fraud and misrepresentation, and which damages the consumers. The most significant change, as I mentioned, in House Bill 2127, the campground law, is one on which the consumer would receive, rather than a right to use, they would receive a fee interest, because the problems, which Stan will explain to you, have been one of bankruptcy or failure of the business, and in which the consumer ends up with a very expensive piece of paper because they had no secured interest and there was no way they could recoup anything. The membership camping campgrounds that you may be familiar with by name, Thousand Trails, Forest Glen, American Adventures, Paradise Cove, that's just an example of some of those we have registered, so you get a feel of who it is that we're talking about under this bill. And I think at this point, if it's agreeable to you, then I'll let Mr. Mayfield proceed with the explanation on House Bill 2126 to begin with, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stan Mayfield with the Real Estate Agency. This bill, I think, as Mr. Chamov explained, has two basic parts to it. The first one relates to the, at least as I have it here on my sheet, relates to the fractional interest description, which is being placed into the statute. There's been some inquiry from local jurisdictions to our office regarding what they believed were timeshares. They wanted to know if they were filed and properly registered, or filed and had a report from us, and after reviewing the paperwork, it was determined that they were not, in fact, timeshares, that they were fractional interests, which the local jurisdictions had some trouble understanding. And with this inclusion of the definition in the statute, it becomes a little clearer as to what the distinction is between the timeshare and the fractional interest. Section 2 of the bill actually excludes fractional interest from having to file. They already are excluded because they don't fit the definition of timeshare, but this just specifically states that so that it's clear. The other part of the bill is allows a judicial remedy for appointment of a trustee for pre-law timeshares. We had one instance where we had a timeshare that was created under the condominium law prior to 1983 enactment, and it changed several hands and actually became inactive as far as marketing. But the people who had purchased it were unable to get control of the unit, and in fact, the units were closed down to the point where the electricity was shut off, and the tenants had some concern over the quality of the asset that was sitting there. And they came to our office. We looked at the statute and determined that they, because of the exclusion in there, could not take advantage of this judicial remedy of appointing a trustee. We recommended they go talk to an attorney. They eventually did, and through extensive negotiations with a California partnership, were finally able to obtain some control over the asset to the point where they could at least maintain it so that it didn't deteriorate. That's one of the reasons that we're looking to at least allow that protection for those timeshares that were created prior to the law. If I can answer any questions, I'll be glad to.
Sounds like we're talking a little bit about what otherwise most of us know as tenants in common.
Well, they are both, in essence, tenants in common of a type. I think what you find is in a timeshare situation, if you buy a timeshare on a given piece of property, your use of it is restricted to the second week in March and the third week in September, basically. That's it under a timeshare plan. If you buy a fractional interest, a one-fifth interest in a condominium, you and your other four partners can live there together 365 days a year because you each have that right 365 days a year. The normal situation is most folks sit down over dinner and say, you take it for Easter, I get it for Christmas, and so on and so forth. But the ownership rights in it are different than those in a timeshare.
That's the tenants in common fractional interest.
True, that part is.
Yeah.
As distinguished from a timeshare
I know that, but okay. I just noticed the definition of fractional interest was very similar to the old, what we know as, in legal terms, as tenants in common, which apparently only two or three of us really know what that means. But anyway, we're seeming to bore the super chair of the committee, but we'll work on that. Any case, any questions from Representative Bell or Representative Bryan about fractional shares and interest and things like that? No questions? Okay. Well, guidance, that's good. I appreciate you understand. We might give you the opportunity to carry this forward. That representation on the record. Do you have anything to add, Commissioner?
No, sir, except that we'd appreciate any help we can get to clean up some of these problems we have that dial our telephone and leave us in the lurch because we can't answer, and this would be a clarification so we can respond to consumers, and so consumers prior to that filing have protection also.
Well, we're grateful to do it for you. Now, we're probably going to move into a work session on this. Is there any public further public testimony on House Bill 2126? Representative Miller?
Mr. Chairman?
Do you want to testify on it?
Amendment, but that'll be a work session.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chamov did point out, and I would concur that I have spoken to Karen Hightower with the State Court Administrator's Office, and their proposed amendment carries forward what we would intend. We're simply looking for somebody to let us know that if a trustee's been appointed for a timeshare plan, that we can take action, and her amendment will do that. So that is sufficient for us.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing now. You folks are up on the next one, aren't you?
Yes,
so
sir.
You can either go back and come forth or you can sit. It doesn't matter to us.
Okay.
But we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2126.
Open the work session.
And open up a work session on House Bill 2126.
Mr. Chairman.
We have Representative Miller, excuse me.
Yes, I'd like to offer an amendment to House Bill 2126 on page 4 of the bill in line 2. I would suggest that we delete the word court and insert the word trustee and delete the word its and insert the court.
The reason we have you up here is we may have a question about this amendment. At least the chair is going to have one, unless someone can explain it to me a little bit. Pay postage. Good point. Trustee is going to be paying for the privilege of sending a copy of this to the commissioner's office rather than the court. Mm-hmm. Question has to be asked is that... Any further discussion of the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? So moved by Representative Miller that on page 4 of the printed bill in line 2, delete the word, quote, court, unquote, and insert, quote, trustee, unquote, and delete, quote, its, unquote, and insert, quote, the court's, unquote, period. Is that correct, Representative Miller?
Almost. There are no quotes that, of course, will go into the
no, but
languages.
That's right. But with the quotes would
designate
who what language
which words are in and which ones were out and which ones we were talking about.
Then. Any further pertinent discussion or relevant to anything that's going on? Any objection to the amendment? It's so ordered.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
I would move House Bill 2126 to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Do we have any discussion of Representative Miller's amendment, proposal to move the House Bill 2126 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation? Representative Clark, anybody, Representative Edmondson, any comments, concerns? We'll go ahead and
Representative Miller's adequately expressed.
Good. And we'll adequately go ahead and take a vote and see how we do. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bryan.
Aye.
Representative Clark.
Aye.
Representative Edmondson.
Aye.
Representative Johnson. Representative Mannix. Representative Miller.
Aye.
Representative Bell.
Aye.
Chair Baum.
Votes aye. Representative Johnson is excused.
Thank you.
Would you like to carry this bill? Oh, okay, I thought maybe you're making some gesture. The measure having received the appropriate vote to move on to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, it's passed out. Representative Bryan, do you have an understanding of this bill and would appreciate taking it to the full committee?
Well, I'd be honored, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, we appreciate that. I'd go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2126 and open up a work session on House Bill 2127. And, Council, would you take the committee for a brief review. Before we get too far into who, those in the room that are interested in House Bill 2375 will be hearing public testimony only on that today. We will not be moving into a work session. So just for every information that's good for you, can use it. Excuse me. Go ahead, Commissioner, if you'd like to go ahead and lead off. Oh, wait. We'll ask Council first. And then you can pick up the pieces.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the commissioner has already explained the basics of this bill. Membership campgrounds are like timeshares. A large chunk of House Bill 2127 is to make the rules relating to timeshares and campgrounds more the same. Two of the major items before the committee in this bill involve creditors' rights. One section of the bill gives campers the right to acquire a piece of the campground so that if the campground operator goes into bankruptcy, the campers will not be left as unsecured creditors and therefore without any funds and without any place to camp. The other major change is one that, again, makes retroactive a requirement that a campground operator have what's called a non-disturbance agreement that prevents the operator's creditor from coming in, say on foreclosure, and displacing the campers that are still there. The materials that you have in front of you include the testimony from the real estate agency together with some amendments that are perhaps slightly more than technical, but are at least clarifying of what's intended here, a copy of the fraud section from the timeshares laws that are being carried into this section, and a copy of the current provision regarding disclosures and sales of campground memberships. There is no fiscal impact with this bill.
Thank you, Counselor. Very good presentation on your part. Commissioner, will you want to go ahead and
I will just lead off a little bit, Chairman Baum, by saying that the membership campground law that we have had has had almost no enforcement and has been very difficult for us to assist consumers in protecting their interest. And with that slight comment, I would let Mr. Mayfield go ahead and explain the virtues of the bill. That's agreeable.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Mayfield.
Chairman Baum, members of the committee, the campground bill attempts to put some enforcement authority and consumer protection into the statute that you'll find in the other statutes that we regulate. Sections 2 and 3 and 4 actually are taken from similar wording you'll find in the subdivision, timeshare, and condominium laws regarding fraudulent activity and the marketing and the advertising of the, in this case, campground. Those are similar to our other land development laws, and we feel they're at least as appropriate to be applied to the marketing and of campground activities. I might point out in Section 4, that is a what we just discussed in the timeshare law, the judicial remedy for appointing a trustee, and my conversations with Ms. Hightower, State Court Administrator, the amendment that she proposed under 2126 would also apply to the provisions you'll find in Section 4, because the wording is essentially the same. It will be found on page 2, line 12. You'll find similar wording regarding the court notification, and probably that should be amended also similarly.
That amendment isn't included in the proposed amendment.
She did not have a memo for you at that because she didn't realize that was in there, and I had forgotten that we had transferred that over. So you do not have any paperwork on that, no.
Okay. Representative Bryan.
Concept on this, how does it